It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, last year saw a record number of enrollments in the Affordable Care Act marketplace. We'll find out why and check out the impact of the health care law. First, thousands of people who aided the U.S. in Afghanistan suddenly left their lives behind last August when the Taliban seized control of the country's capital and the American military evacuated their allies. Those evacuees are finally arriving at their new homes in Wisconsin and across the country in recent months. As Hope Kerwin reports, in collaboration with PBS Wisconsin, some Afghans say they're preparing to navigate the culture shock and potential immigration barriers they'll face as they start their new lives.
Shir Khan, his wife, and three children arrived at Fort McCoy in western Wisconsin in September. At first, their days were filled with immigration paperwork and getting used to their new surroundings. But waiting for the resettlement placement in Massachusetts became harder as winter weather forced them inside and left them with little to do. Before finally leaving for their new home in mid-January, Khan said they were most looking forward to having privacy again after living in a communal barracks with several other families.
People from different backgrounds came here. Like sometimes it is noisy inside. Sometimes we don't get along well.
Khan is a journalist. In Kabul, he worked for a company that implemented U.S.-funded projects. Khan said he had no plans to leave his home country before Kabul fell to the Taliban last August. His work made him a target of the armed Islamist group, and he wanted his children to get a better education than what would be possible under Taliban rule. But leaving their life behind hasn't been easy.
I was part of the middle class. Because I had a job, I had a house, I had family and friends, relatives, and connections with the people who were somehow in power. But when we came here, like, we lost control of almost everything.
Khan said he's grateful that he and his family survived and are now safe, but he knows adjusting to life in America will be difficult at first. He hopes his new neighbors will be understanding.
I might speak English. That's understandable, but that doesn't necessarily mean I know every single thing about the culture. That's why some people, including me, might behave strangely.
This culture shock is something Matula Mate and his family are navigating 1 month after arriving at their new home in Wausau. Mate says there are a lot of new systems to learn, like American traffic signals.
If the traffic light be the red, they might be crossing and thinking this is the walkway.
Mate is a tribal leader from southern Afghanistan. He worked for the U.S. Marines for 5 years, helping to recruit local workers for infrastructure projects. Mate says those military connections are what helped him escape with his wife and 6 children shortly after the Taliban's takeover. After months of staying on a military base in Virginia, they now live in a small 2-story home within walking distance of a bus stop and grocery store. Mate says his family has gotten a warm welcome in Wausau, and he's enjoyed getting to know his new neighbors, sometimes hosting them in his home over milk tea.
We are Afghans, like having more guests.
Mate says he's working on plans to start his own business, but his biggest worry is that his application for a special immigration visa, often called an SIV, hasn't been approved yet.
That is not only difficult for me or problem for me, that is the problem for all Afghans, especially for those people whom can't speak English.
He imagines for non-English speakers, the process can feel like fumbling in the dark. Because of their work for the U.S., Mate and Shir Khan are able to apply for an SIV. Other Afghans are eligible for special priority in the U.S. Refugee Admissions Program because of their work or identity. But Madison-based immigration attorney Grant Sovereign says everyone else will have to quickly apply for asylum once they reach their new address. And he agrees with Mate that many would struggle to navigate the process on their own.
It is inherently difficult for somebody who doesn't speak the language, has just come from a traumatic situation, which is basically anyone applying for asylum, and not having the means to get that kind of help.
Sovereign says Congress could create an easier path to residency for evacuees, but he thinks that's unlikely given the controversy around immigration. Mate says he's still hopeful that policymakers will take action to help Afghans like him. He says residency would allow him to travel one day and offer him security about his future in the U.S. Hope Kerwin, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Hope Kerwin joins us now for more. Hope, welcome back to the show.
Happy to be here.
And Marissa Wojcik is series producer for Here and Now on PBS Wisconsin. She's been reporting on this story as well. You can find links to both of their reporting at wpr.org/centraltime. Marissa, thanks for joining us.
Happy to be here as well.
Hope, let's start with you. We just heard some of the conversations you had with evacuees. One thing that stuck out is that Fort McCoy here in Wisconsin is just one step of many that these families have taken. What kind of things did people tell you about what the journey from Afghanistan to Wisconsin has been like?
Right. There were many steps in their journey, even before they made it to military bases like Fort McCoy. For many people, even just making it to the airport in the capital city of Kabul was a harrowing journey in and of itself. But after they left Afghanistan, most folks went to a military base in another country, often Germany or Qatar, where they received immigration screening. From there, they traveled to the U.S. and eventually made their way to one of eight military bases, including Fort McCoy. There, they went through more immigration processing and then simply had to wait for one of the U.S.'s resettlement agencies here in the U.S. to find a new community for them to settle in. And so I definitely heard from both of the people that I talked to that waiting process was at times difficult. Both people expressed a lot of gratitude for being able to come to the U.S., for being able to leave their situation in Afghanistan that put them at risk. However, you know, leaving a stable life where you have your own home and a routine and, you know, neighbors, connections, and transitioning to living in a communal barracks, often with several other families who you don't know, who are maybe from different backgrounds or used to different ways of living. There's definitely a lot of change there. I mean, I spoke with one person who talked about, you know, just a sheet being able to, you know, separate his family with three small children from other families and trying to navigate if someone wants to listen to music, but someone wants to read a book. How do you navigate those differences?
And Marissa, you've also been reporting on this. You focused, among other things, on the legal system that refugees have to navigate. What kind of things did you hear were big challenges or even roadblocks for people?
Yeah, so as you know, this happened very, very quickly, and a lot of things had to be figured out for this massive scale of people in a very short amount of time. And no matter what, the United States legal system and the immigration system is the immigration system. So people who came from Afghanistan, at first it was expected that most people were going to be coming on special immigrant visas, which are given out when people have been working with the United States. However, again, because this happened so quickly, that process can take up to 3 years in certain cases. And so people either were somewhere in the midst of that process or they hadn't started it yet. And normally that happens when the person is not inside the United States already. So it was very confusing as to how to go about this. And then on top of that, you need to still have maintained the connection to whatever military personnel or United States company that you worked for and have all the documentation. So there's so many different steps. So because a lot of special immigrant visas were really just kind of not possible in the chaos of this evacuation, an attorney, an immigration attorney that I spoke with, estimated roughly 50 to 60% of Afghan refugees who have come to the United States are under what's called this temporary parole status. And this specific parole status was for these Afghan refugees and it lasts 2 years. And very, very specifically, because immigration is not simple, it's parole status for humanitarian purposes. And even immigration attorneys were getting confused because on the flip side, there's something completely different called humanitarian parole, but it's not the same thing. And so now people have to start applying for asylum if they are under this temporary parole status. And the asylum process, again, within the U.S. immigration system is very complicated. And if people don't get that process started and finished within 2 years, there is potential that they could be deported and taken back to Afghanistan. And there's very limited legal services. So there's concern right now that immigration attorneys, especially working pro bono, will be able to handle the cases in front of them.
And Hope, it sounds like there's a lot of uncertainty. Legal, as Marissa was just talking about, issues about what job people will have, where they're going to live. Do you, in talking to a couple of the evacuees there, do you get a sense of kind of a hunger to at least get something stable going and start this whole new chapter in their lives?
Yeah, I mean, I think that both of the, you know, Afghan men that I spoke with, both, you know, had already been thinking about what they hoped their life would look like here in the U.S., right? I mean, this is kind of the situation that they've been thrust into. And so they are just thinking about, you know, what they hope to do if they can return to, you know, working in their previous careers. I spoke to one man who is a journalist, as was heard in my feature. And, you know, he was thinking about, you know, how can he get back into journalism and start contributing positively again. You know, he talked about being frustrated that he wasn't really making a difference or being able to do work that makes a difference when he was spending time on base. So I definitely think that was like a common theme that I heard of people eager to kind of start their lives here, but also being intimidated by that process, thinking about how different life in America is going to be for them, and kind of having to learn all new systems, like how to ride a bus or even things like when to cross the street as a pedestrian. You know, those are very different here in the U.S. than they were in Afghanistan. And so, you know, they both talked about it would, you know, Afghans like themselves are just going to need time to learn those things. And they're also going to need their new neighbors to be patient and even maybe generous with their time to reach out and help them.
And Marissa, as we wrap up, the coverage this week involved PBS, WPR, WisContext. What parts of this story are you keeping an eye on next for maybe potential reporting down the road?
Yeah, as people are seeking different services and especially legal immigration services, we're keeping in touch with the immigration attorneys that that gave us some information in this story, and basically understanding how that process is going for people and seeing if there are certain kind of bureaucratic holdups or anything like that that are preventing people from finding kind of safe legal asylum passages to the United States. That's probably the biggest thing that we are focusing on. And I'll say that at least in Madison, it seems like the Afghan folks that are resettling in the area are connecting and helping one another in translating and finding cultural orientation. And so there might be some reporting in that area as well.
We'll leave it there. Marissa, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
And Hope, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you.
Hope Kerwin is a WPR reporter based in La Crosse. Marissa Wojcik is the assistant news director for PBS Wisconsin. They talked with us today about the reporting on the resettlement process for Afghan refugees. You can find a link to their stories at WPR.org/Central Time. In just a minute, we'll talk with the head of Wisconsin Resettlement Agency based in the Fox Valley, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about the process of getting settled in a new home, how it works for these evacuees from Afghanistan? Have you been involved in this process? Have you volunteered helping out with this kind of work before? Is the refugee system part of your family's story? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk about where the resettlement process stands for people who fled Taliban rule in Afghanistan last August. Some of them ended up at Fort McCoy in Wisconsin and are now finding homes here in the state and around the country. Tammy McLaughlin joins us now, Office Director for World Relief Fox Valley in Appleton. Tammy, welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Rob. It's always great to be with you.
Can you talk a bit about what it's been like, what kind of things your group has been doing since those first families from Afghanistan arrived in the Fox Valley, I think back in November?
Yeah, so we've been welcoming Afghan newcomers. What that means is securing housing, furnishing that housing. We meet them at the airport. If they come from Fort McCoy, they're driven here. So we meet them either at their new home or some are staying in hotels until we find permanent housing. We're enrolling people in schools and benefits and making medical appointments. We're just really, really, really busy. A lot of it is very task-based type items, and it's really just to help people land and stabilize well when they get here.
What kind of things are you hearing from evacuees about what they're hoping for here in Wisconsin?
Well, the first thing, warmer weather. And that truly has been one of the points in every conversation that we've had. This is a hard place to welcome people. We've had such a cold snap. But we assure people that our spring and summer and falls are much, much more beautiful. But they, you know, seriously, and truly, again, that is a concern for some of the people. But just really want to start settling. You know they have to start over. They've left so much behind, and that includes not only family and friends, but possessions and homes and educations and careers, and just really have to start over. So they're ready and willing to get started as soon as possible.
As we heard from our reporters there, part of the story is the culture shock, moving from Afghanistan to Wisconsin very quickly. Things like crossing the street even are open questions. What are some of the little things that you're finding are common themes or questions from people from Afghanistan?
You know, those same types of things. I think we hear more of the bigger issues about a family. My family's still there. Do you think, you know, we'll be able to be reunited? What about the immigration process, which you've recently discussed, you know, just minutes ago? So those types of things are still those big things that they're concerned about. So we try and just, you know, give them a sense of peace. Hey, let's focus on this right now. Let's focus on what's set before you. Let's get your kids enrolled in school. Let's get you enrolled in English classes, because that's also something very important to them. They want to learn, and they want to learn English, and they want their kids to be educated here. So although it's a high level, like big worry, we just try and say, hey, let's take it day by day and do the simple things, and you'll start seeing progress.
Talking to Tammy McLaughlin with World Relief Fox Valley in Appleton, looking at the resettlement process for Afghan evacuees, settling some of them in the Appleton area. Tammy, what kind of response have you gotten from local volunteers and community groups?
Incredible response. We are so pleased and so thrilled at the response of the community. We have a model called Good Neighbor Teams, which is a church that walks the churches, small groups that walk alongside refugee families. And they've been at the airport. We had one the other night at 10:45 there at the airport meeting, waiting to welcome their family. I mean, what better sense of, hey, I'm welcomed here, I'm wanted here and received here, than to have new friends meeting you at the airport? You know, we've had volunteers help with grocery shopping, simple things like haircuts, some pretty big things like taking people to medical appointments. We have a family who has two children who need to go to Green Bay twice a week for medical treatments. I mean, it's a huge scale, small scale, and everything in between. And we couldn't do this work that we're doing without the support and partnership of community partners as well as volunteers that have really stepped into this resettlement effort.
Is there any kind of particular need right now of kinds of donations or particular volunteer needs or anything else that you're looking at right now?
We'll just continue to, onboard volunteers. We take that very seriously. We want to train people well, help them understand culture, help them understand the Afghan experience, those types of things. And then we will continue to pair people as much as we can, because we know that extra support and enhancement of what we're trying to teach, you know, if partners are walking alongside, reiterating that and practicing, that just makes for a better experience and more, a deeper resettlement and deeper roots when you have that community reinforcement. So we're just going to continue to onboard volunteers as many as we can and continue to pair up as much as we can. We think that's really critical, not only short term, but long term too. You know, some things take longer to get a sense of. So we know that this is not a short term effort. It's not a 30, 60, 90 day. We want to continue to walk alongside our newcomers as long as we can.
You joined us over the past few years and talked about a big drop in the number of refugees under Trump administration rules. Now here's a big group coming all at once. Was it kind of going from zero to 60 for you real quick?
It's What do they say? You're building the building the plane as you're flying it. Yeah, it's been a heavy lift because it's, you know, we have a mass amount of people coming and we're trying to rebuild our staff, you know, from the past several years. So, again, couldn't have done this effort without volunteers. We also know this has been difficult for partners because they also haven't been staffed up. But one of the benefits in the Fox Valley is we are resettling in Menasha and Appleton and Oshkosh. So we have partners in all three of those locations. So that has spread, you know, the volume in some respects. And I think that's made it a little easier on partners. But again, the volunteers have been incredibly amazing and beneficial and impactful in this resettlement initiative.
And just our last minute, is there anything about the either the evacuees you've worked with or the resettlement process that you think gets left out of the conversation or the media coverage you've seen?
Well, we've alluded to it, but, you know, the resettlement program, this program was designed by our Congress to be a public and private partnership, a collaborative effort amongst many sectors of a community. And I've been working in resettlement for 8 years. I have never seen that collaborative effort unfold like it has the past couple months. It's been inspiring and encouraging just to see the community surround this, you know, our newcomers like they have. And again, this is the way it was designed to be. So it's really, really been just a privilege to work in this environment in such a collaborative community. And I think all of our Wisconsin communities are equally as collaborative. Thank you.
Tammy, thanks again for joining us today.
Oh, thank you. Really appreciate your interest and all you do for us. Thank you.
That's Tammy McLaughlin, Office Director for World Relief Fox Valley, based in Appleton. She talked to us about her group's work in resettling evacuees from Afghanistan. Earlier, we talked to WPR reporter Hope Kerwin and Marissa Wojcik from PBS Wisconsin about their coverage of the issue. You can find their stories over at WPR.org/Central Time. Coming up after the news, health insurance enrollment through the Affordable Care Act marketplaces increased over 20% last year. We'll find out what's driving the jump in the use of those marketplaces. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll talk to two youth mental health experts about the importance of household gun safety and how some simple steps can lead to a safer home. Now, health insurance enrollment through the Affordable Care Act marketplaces is up 21% from a year ago. That number is likely higher as the final numbers aren't out yet. When he took office a year into the pandemic, President Biden enacted policies that would make it easier to sign up for health insurance through the ACA. For example, giving people more time to sign up. We're talking about this jump in ACA marketplace enrollment that happened this year and what it means, and you could join in at 800-642-1234. Did you sign up for healthcare through the Affordable Care Act this year? Have you used this in the past? Did you use the extra time you had to make that sign up? Do you have questions about how it all works and who it serves? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Coleman Drake is an assistant professor in the Department of Health Policy and Management at the University of Pittsburgh Graduate School of Public Health. Coleman, thanks a lot for joining us today.
It's great to be here. Thank you for having me.
Before we dig into these numbers, Coleman, can you remind us what this marketplace is and who it's intended to serve?
Sure. So we're talking about healthcare.gov. This is the health insurance marketplace created under the 2010 Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act, commonly known as Obamacare. Now, that law had a lot of other important components to it, most notably the Medicaid expansion that has been adopted by most states. The Wisconsin is not one of them. But a big part of it also is healthcare.gov and these marketplaces that are used in other states, which now are a source of insurance for around 15 million people, about what has been 8 years since it was enacted at the start of 2014. And the idea here is to provide a internet platform where people can go to compare and shop for health insurance plans, and depending on their incomes, receive subsidies to purchase those health insurance plans.
What do you see driving this large number of enrollees, people who enrolled for coverage in 2022?
Well, I think there's really kind of five different factors, though they are all related to recent policy changes and the Biden administration's approach to the Affordable Care Act. First and foremost, I would say that the enhanced subsidies offered by the American Rescue Plan really made a difference. We went from a world where health insurance plans were deeply discounted for customers, but now we're in a world where not only are they deeply discounted for a lot of people, they are free or nearly free. Another big bit was that the Biden administration had an extended enrollment period that went on through much of 2021, providing an outlet for people that were having gaps in health insurance to sign up and receive coverage through the marketplaces. Let's see. I'd also point out open enrollment was extended into January. People are paying more attention to health insurance coverage, perhaps because of COVID. And the administration has just made a priority out of making people aware of their health insurance options through the marketplace and elsewhere. So we saw in the previous administration, there was sort of a substantial decrease in health insurance coverage programs when that administration took power. And then as the Biden administration has taken power and done a lot of outreach, enrollment has gone back up quite a bit. So number of related factors.
Big picture in this 8 years since the act came into place, this particular element of it, these marketplaces, how much of a difference have they made in the overall number of Americans who have some kind of health care coverage?
Yeah, so like I said, there's, and I think you said at the start of the program too, there's about 15 million people that are covered through the marketplaces right now. And I think the way to answer that question kind of in a contemporary, and by contemporary, I mean post or intra-COVID setting, is that these marketplaces have provided a sort of cushion for a lot of people that perhaps didn't had unstable access to health insurance as a result of the pandemic, and have also provided insurance to people that some that didn't have it and some that had insurance that might have not had as good of benefits as we would have seen prior to the Affordable Care Act. So every plan sold on the marketplaces has what's called essential health benefits, which means that you can expect them to cover things like preventive health services and visits to the hospital and substance use disorder treatment that wasn't always covered under older health insurance plans.
As you mentioned, the COVID pandemic led to some of these policy changes from the Biden administration and investments in a relief bill. Do you see just a raising awareness of the need for healthcare being driven by this pandemic? Maybe that's an incentive for people who might have been on the fence earlier.
Yeah. So like you said, there's kind of these two interacting forces here, which one is just with the COVID pandemic being out there. You know, it's kind of hard to validate this with research so far, but it stands to reason that a lot of people might have said to themselves, well, this might not be the best time to be going without health insurance. And that by itself could drive interest in health insurance options, including the marketplaces and Medicaid. But also, like you said, the administration had its extended open enrollment period last year as a result of the pandemic. So that certainly enabled some of those people that could have been searching for health insurance options to take advantage of them.
Talking to Coleman Trake, assistant professor in the Department of Health Policy and Management at the University of Pittsburgh's Graduate School of Public Health, looking at the Affordable Care Act and a jump in enrollments in the Affordable Care Act marketplace coming into 2022. You can join in at 800-642-1234 if you have a question about the marketplace and how it works. If you have an experience with it, for better or worse, let us know. 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We heard from Diane in Emerald, who couldn't stay on the line, but she says she was on Obamacare for a short time. The coverage was fine, she says, but she came into some money mid-year that she wasn't expecting, so she wound up taking a tax hit at the end of it. Do things get complicated if our eligibility changes midway through a year, Coleman?
Yeah, so when one's income changes particularly significantly, that can affect the size of the subsidy that that someone receives. So, for example, let's see, if your income is below about 150% of the federal poverty level, about $18,000, you can sign up for kind of a standard plan on the marketplaces literally for free. But if your income were to double, it could cost a few hundred dollars a month, literally about around $200. So if someone does have a, you know, inheritance or something of the sort that comes halfway through the year, that could result in tax implications. Now, that being said, you can call up your health insurer and healthcare.gov if that kind of thing happens to you and figure out what your adjusted premium is going to be at the time. If you don't do that, it will be reconciled on your taxes next year. But this also has an upside. If people experience a significant decrease in income during the year, their subsidy will increase and they should take advantage of that. So this is, the subsidies are very much dependent on income, and people should be cognizant of that.
One question at various points, especially the earlier years of the Affordable Care Act, was, would people have options in different parts of the country to care plans under these marketplaces? There are concerns that, you know, this place might just have two options. This place might have one. Maybe there wouldn't even be one. How has that shaken out since that was, it seemed like a larger concern?
Yeah, so that's a great question. And, I've been knee deep in the research since the start, and it's just been such a turnaround. I remember 2015, 2017, mm-hmm. or not 2015 so much, but 2017, 18, and 19. You had a lot of particularly rural states to the west of Wisconsin, but even some parts of Wisconsin, I believe, that were, you only had a single insurer to choose from on the marketplaces. And that was particularly bad for people who whose incomes were above the subsidy cap. Now, that subsidy cap is gone, so not so much of an issue there. But also the issue is largely gone because insurers have been jumping into these marketplaces for the last couple of years to the point that they're in a lot of places more competitive now than they've ever been. The entire state of Nebraska now has four insurers competing in the marketplaces, and Wisconsin competition is up quite a bit as well. So really just a sea change there, where this is just not a not an issue that we're really seeing states very concerned about anymore.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Bill is with us in Madison. Hi, Bill.
Yeah, hi. So I was on Obamacare for a couple of different years, which worked out fantastic for me because I was able to find a great plan. It had a $2,000 max out of pocket. I have epilepsy. I have type 1 diabetes. So, okay, I had to pay a fair amount up front. But once I hit that with the pumps and everything, 100% coverage. Well, now I got on disability. I was automatically enrolled on Medicare. So instead of $8,000, which was pretty high, I paid $13,000 last year. Medicare this year just tripled my insulin cost. It won't let me get my seizure meds without a fight. Medicare for all is ridiculous. The Obamacare was just fantastic. I did have to pay a penalty briefly 1 year because I estimated my income incorrectly. But it was just fantastic for me.
Interesting. Bill, thanks so much for sharing that story. Sorry about those high costs, especially of the insulin material. Coleman, that's not how it's supposed to work in some ways, right? People, if they go from Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act, sorry, to Medicare, do we expect them to take a hit like Bill is talking about?
Well, it depends. If you were getting a really beneficial, really generous plan through healthcare.gov, that is... it's really kind of hard to find insurance that's better than that, especially at the, if you're making $15,000 a year, the generosity of the health insurance coverage you can get on healthcare.gov is just fantastic. So I can absolutely, it's not surprising to me to hear that a transition from maybe one of those types of plans to Medicare could well result in more cost exposure.
Bill, thanks a lot for sharing your experience with us. Coleman Drake is with us, assistant professor in the Department of Health Policy and Management at the University of Pittsburgh. We're talking to him about the record number of signups in the last Affordable Care Act open enrollment period, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you signed up for insurance through healthcare.gov in the last year or the last few years? We want to hear from you. Why did you sign up? What do you like about it? What parts of it were more trouble for you maybe than you think they were worth? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk about the increase in health insurance enrollments through government marketplaces in the last year. Coleman Drake is with us, assistant professor in the Department of Health Policy and Management at the University of Pittsburgh. You can join in with your questions, your thoughts, your experiences with the Affordable Care Act, especially these marketplaces. You can call in at 800-642-1234 if you have a healthcare.gov experience to share. That's 800-642-1234. Coleman, we heard from Sue in Little Hope, who asks, what is the cost of Obamacare to the taxpayer? How does it compare to the original estimates when it was first passed? Well, it's a massive question. What do we know about that, Coleman?
Yeah, sure thing. So let me try and answer this. So this is a kind of, you could have a very long conversation on right. The subject. So the original Affordable Care Act came in, I believe, around, it was passed in 2010. Estimates were around $1 trillion for the past decade. That being said, there was a lot else going on in there besides the marketplaces. Mm-hmm. Again, Medicaid expansion, various kinds of changes to payment models, things like that. So what we're looking at essentially going forward, and I think the relevant number kind of for budgetary discussions is the Biden administration is facing this decision along with Congress to extend the additional subsidies associated with the American Rescue Plan. And the Congressional Budget Office has estimated that the cost of doing that for this decade is going to be $74 billion or $7.4 billion per year. So that's the overall cost. When I bring up those numbers, I like to mention to people that the kind of frame of comparison is employer-sponsored insurance. One could do a comparison to Medicaid, but Medicaid insurers get paid a lot less than the marketplace or the employer-sponsored insurance insurers do. So broadly speaking, marketplace insurance is roughly as expensive to provide as giving a person insurance through their job. And the reason for that is that in the marketplaces, you get a subsidy to purchase health insurance. And if your employer provides you health insurance, they provide you with, rather they get a tax exclusion to provide health insurance to you. So to elaborate on that a little bit, if you're paid a dollar by your employer, you might only see about 80 cents of that in wages, depending on where you sit with your tax rate. But if they spend a dollar on your health insurance, they will spend literally, you will get a dollar of it because that's entirely tax exempt. So as a result of this setup, providing health insurance through employers ends up being very costly for the federal government. In fact, it's the single biggest line item in the federal budget. To wrap that up and to summarize, providing insurance through healthcare.gov or the marketplaces per person is roughly around as expensive as what we're dealing with to provide insurance to people through how we most commonly do for non-elderly adults, employer-sponsored insurance.
Let's go back to our callers at 800-642-1234. Kent is with us in Monona. Kent, hi.
Hey, Rob. I just wanted to share that a couple years ago, I had to have a surgery. It was a minor surgery, and had every complication in the book from it. I was unable to work for the last couple of years between that and the pandemic, and the marketplace really got me a really good insurance plan. I had 9 surgeries over the last 2 years to fix the issues, and I would be in the hole about $200,000 right now if it wasn't for the marketplace, which had, I got a $3,000 out-of-pocket max, and then everything else was 100% covered. And when the rescue plan kicked in, I actually got a credit back to me for the subsidies and whatnot.
Kent, thanks for sharing that story. Sorry about what sounds like a medical nightmare. I'm glad it wasn't also a financial nightmare for you. Coleman, Kent's story is one of the goals of the Affordable Care Act in the first place, right? Making sure that a situation where somebody has to have, as in Kent's case, lots of surgeries doesn't end up financially ruined for life afterward.
Yeah, I think that absolutely. I'm glad to hear it worked out so well for Kent, at least on the financial side.
Right.
The context of the passage of the Affordable Care Act was very much the financial crisis, now over a decade behind us. But you might remember uninsured rates were approaching 20% at a time when many families were experiencing other financial hardships to boot. And I remember a speech I heard Rep. John Yarmuth from Kentucky talking about, we saw those uninsured rates creeping up and we felt we needed to do something about it. So the impetus was very much to try and provide people with a source of health insurance that they could rely on, even if they were experiencing some either coming down with some health conditions that or uncertainty in their labor market and what's going on with their jobs, but also to provide health insurance to people who maybe didn't work for a large employer or didn't have or just weren't getting a good offer of health insurance from their employer. So they could still have access to subsidized health insurance in a similar way to people who get insurance through their employer, but to be able to not have to deal with job-related uncertainty or just jobs that don't provide access to health insurance. So, yeah, I think that's exactly how the law was supposed to work.
Thanks again for calling in, Kent. We're talking to Coleman Drake from the University of Pittsburgh, expert on health policy, looking at the Affordable Care Act. Coleman, there have been some kind of up and down, all or nothing debates on the Affordable Care Act, efforts to repeal it a few years back. You've written about some changes, some tweaks you'd like to see to the Affordable Care Act over the last few years. What kind of things are top of mind for you?
Well, I think the biggest thing by far right now is the continuation of the subsidies from the American Rescue Plan. I think shortly after the law went into effect, it became clear that the subsidies needed to be a bit larger to really provide the kind of access that the framers of the law were hoping for. And that's been affected under the American Rescue Plan. So I like to see how affordable things are right now, and I'd like to see that continue. Sure. Pausing for a moment here. I'd like to see that continue. And the other concern with now that these subsidies have been temporarily implemented is that if they aren't extended, people could then see their premiums revert to what they were prior to the American Rescue Plan. And that could put people in an unfortunate situation where this time next year, they're seeing that their health insurance premiums have increased substantially, and that could be particularly problematic for people that have $0 premiums right now, who don't have to do anything month to month to keep their health insurance. They would then need to go back online and set up a recurring credit card payment or send checks in the mail on a monthly basis. And I'd be worried that people might not be aware that change is coming and could end up being uninsured. So, by far and above, that's what I'd like to see change with the law. The other thing I think is that there was a really successful policy in Massachusetts back when they had their kind of precursor to the Affordable Care Act, which has been dubbed Romney Care because Mitt Romney was the governor when that law was passed. And what they did was they changed things so when people didn't meet their monthly payment a few months in a row, just forgot or were having difficulties getting the payment out or whatever, rather than make the person lose their insurance and become uninsured, they were automatically switched to a plan with a $0 premium. And what that accomplished is maybe their coverage generosity went down, but then they weren't completely, they didn't go from being generously insured to completely uninsured overnight. And I think I'd like to see some changes affected to that extent in the marketplaces as well. It was very successful at keeping people insured.
Coleman, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.
Coleman Drake is an assistant professor in the Department of Health, Policy, and Management at the University of Pittsburgh's Graduate School of Public Health. He talked to us today about an increase in enrollment for coverage under the Affordable Care Act marketplace, a record coming into 2022. Still time for you to share your experiences. If you've looked at getting coverage at healthcare.gov, did you end up getting it? What steered you away from it if you didn't? What was your experience like under that kind of coverage? Are you one of the people who joined up maybe for the first time coming into this year? You can email ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org, or tweet us at Central Time WPR. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer-Kent, kick off a series of interviews with candidates for mayor of Wisconsin's largest city. That's coming up tomorrow morning at 7 here on the Ideas Network. Here on Central Time, we have a regular feature called Food Friday, and we often talk to authors of new cookbooks. But for two new cookbooks, we might have to develop a new skill set that we don't always think of in the kitchen. Deep sea diving. As reported by NPR, a storm in the Mid-Atlantic sent some cargo spilling overboard from a ship. That cargo included the complete print editions of two new cookbooks. The books were Mason Hereford's Turkey and the Wolf, Flavor Tripping in New Orleans, and Melissa Clark's Dinner in One, Exceptional and Easy One-Pan Meals. NPR talked to Clark, who took things in stride, saying she hoped the fish enjoyed the books, though there are some seafood recipes that might freak them out. For us humans, if we want to check out those recipes, we'll have to take a dangerous journey to Davy Jones's locker and back. Or just wait for the new print run to come out, or get the books online. Cooking from the briny deep, this is Central Time.